Hello and welcome to the show this evening. And I have to say, this is going to be—I would call it a humdinger of a show. That seems fitting. It's going to be a great show tonight. My guests are Dr. Mark Roediger and David Marler, and we're going to be talking about them working basically with the largest collection of UFO case files, the J. Allen Hynek Center for the UFO Studies, CUFO's archives. And we're going to be talking about current events and all that. For those of you that can see me on YouTube, you can see that I lost my battle a couple of days ago with a electric razor. You know, I was trying to cut my hair on the lawn the other day, and I couldn't find all the attachments to my electric razor. And I looked like I had, well, this is something Rodney Dangerfield might say. I had more divots on my head than a beginner's golf course. I guess that's what I'm going to say. It looked really, really bad, so I just buzzed it. And anyway, I don't mind it that much. I might keep it. It's low maintenance, and I like low maintenance these days. It's been a crazy week. We go here to escape crazy weeks, so I want to welcome you all. A little extra housekeeping today, so please bear with me. Our blog this week, this is the last in this series of three. It's called Injured by the UFO. Charles Lear goes into the Brazilian cases starting back in 1977. So check that out on our podcast, UFO.com website. And that's also an audio blog every single week. So don't forget that. I want to give a shout out to a great friend of the show. I first heard from Lee McDonald all the way back in 2012 when he reached out to me. He's from Canada. Lee's going through a really hard medical time. And I just hope he pulls through okay and does all right. And you always knew when Lee was in the chat room because it'd be a lot of those LOLs. You know, I mean, he always makes people laugh. He's a real funny guy, even now. And we're pulling for you, Lee, so hang in there. So if you support the show, I want to thank you very much. I couldn't do it without you. And if you'd like to know more about that, that's over at Patreon, Martin Willis Podcast UFO. The link is on the website. And I think that is going to do it for now. I'm going to bring in my guests. Hang on. I got to do a little navigating here. And welcome, everyone.
Hi.
Martin.
All right. So we got Dave Marler. He's been on the show a number of times. And Mark Roediger. And most people know you, Dave, because you've been on, I don't know, maybe 10 times. Still not enough, though. In my and but Mark, you were on back in 2015. Time is flying.
Yes, so, I did that.
Yeah, if you can give us a little nutshell about your background, if you would.
Well, I've been involved in the field a long time and been interested in it even longer. You know, I grew up in the 60s, and so I was around when all that UFO excitement was occurring, with the Blue Book and the sightings and the Condon Project and, you know, all of those things.
Wow.
And so my interest, of course, was piqued by all that. And I was very fortunate. I grew up near Chicago. So when Allen Hynek started the center in late 1973, you know, I vowed to myself that now is the time. I've got to get involved and volunteer. And I was an undergrad at the time and in college. So I did. It took a while to convince him, but I got involved and have stayed with it, you know, through thick and thin, mostly through thin. You know, eventually joined the center board back in 1980, if you can believe that long ago. And then unfortunately, when Allen moved away and then passed away way too early in 1986, you know, I was appointed the scientific director of the center. No one else wants the job, so I still have it after all these years. How about that?
I love it. Yeah.
So there's your quick, recap, right?
No, thank you very much. David, just real quick for the first time listener.
Oh, sure. Well, I've been actively involved in UFO research since 1990, started in MUFON back in 1990 and was state section director for Illinois. And I mentioned that because that's how Mark and I first met, was both being in Illinois.
Whose phone is ringing, by the way?
It's stopped now. Yeah, I got it stopped. Yeah.
Okay.
There we go. Thanks.
Go ahead.
So being Illinois state director, that's how Mark and I met and started corresponding as Illinois state director for MUFON and Mark representing CUFOS. And so it's hard to believe, Mark, it's been that many years that we've known each other already. Yeah. But that's how we kind of crossed paths, essentially, and have kept in touch over the years. And, you know, have continued to do a lot of historical research. You mentioned Charles Lear. I just recently shared some information to assist with his burn victim blog that he's been working on. Yeah. And really commend him for doing that research. But, you know, and of course, my book on triangular UFOs, which is still rather timely, given the recent announcement of a naval pilot that's purportedly took a photo of a triangular UFO last year, which hopefully will eventually be released.
I would love to see that coming up out of the ocean and well described. And from what I understood, I was hearing about this for several months, but the people telling me said, don't tell anyone, but it's going viral in the Defense Department, this picture.
Yeah.
You know, and so I had to, you know, the people that told me, two people told me not to tell anyone. So I had to not say anything about that. But anyway, I'm going to play this clip. Now, this came out today. This is on a NPR segment called Here and Now. Peter O'Dowd and Allison Hagen do that each week. I think there's these interviews. And this is Seth Shostak. And I heard this on the radio today, and I said, oh, my God, I got to talk about this. So this is 3 minutes and 38 seconds. Hang in there. Here it goes.
Dig into the details of the big pandemic relief bill and spending package passed late last year, and you'll see an unusual demand. U.S. intelligence agencies have 180 days to tell Congress what they know about unidentified aerial phenomena. You and I know them as UFOs. Agencies also have to explain how they analyze encounters with UFOs and if they're a national security threat. Joining us now is Seth Shostak. He's a senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. Seth, welcome.
Thank you very much, Peter.
And a casual observer might hear this and wonder if it's a joke. But what do you think about this UFO provision in the new law?
Well, it's strangely placed, of course, in a law that really doesn't have much to do with any of this, but it's certainly not unprecedented. Back in the early 50s and the mid-50s, there was a whole slew of programs to investigate unidentified aerial phenomena. So this is nothing new.
In fact, just last year, April 2020, the Pentagon declassified three videos taken by Navy pilots that show unidentified objects flying at high speeds near their planes. Let's listen to some of the sound from one of those videos.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. Oh my gosh. They're all going against the wind. The wind's 120 knots to the west. The whole thing, dude.
And we'll link to those videos at hereandnow.org. They were leaked. The Pentagon says they're real. What do you think? Did those videos change some minds about UFOs?
Well, I don't know whether they've changed many minds to begin with. You know, polls have shown that like one third of the American public already believes that the aliens are, you know, visiting Earth. So I don't know that it was a surprise. And these videos actually weren't secret videos. They just, you know, let them loose. And you do see some strange things in them. But that doesn't mean they're alien craft.
What do you see in them?
Well, there's one where you see sort of a what looks like a, I don't know, a tic tac. And then it kind of rotates around a little bit. Now, could it be, you know, a UFO? Could it be aliens who've come to, you know, take a look at our planet? Or could it be, for example, an internal reflection in the cameras, the infrared cameras that were used on this kind of aircraft? It's a Hornet F-8. And by the way, I think that's an important point. These things were only seen with cameras on F-8s. It's like, you know, driving through the Pacific Northwest and you see Bigfoot, but only if you're driving a Chevy. Any other car won't see it. So, you know, there's something peculiar about it right there. And there are plenty of people who think that the answer is that what you're seeing are problems with the cameras.
Well, I do appreciate your skepticism. You know, there was a Defense Department program from 2007 to 2012 called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. What do you think that this upcoming report from the intelligence agencies might reveal?
I think that the Navy's interest, or should I say the government's interest in this, it's not that they're worried that, you know, little green guys have come for a house call. I think that they're more concerned that there's some sort of military technology being deployed by potential enemies, right? That's always been the interest in UFOs from the military's point of view. So I see this initiative in the same light. It's an attempt by the military to sort of standardize the reporting, do some investigation, and see if they can figure out what these things are. I think if they were really aliens, you know, they wouldn't be so passive and just tease the Navy. Why are they so interested in our military?
Seth Shostak, a senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. I wish we had more time, but thank you very much for what you've given us here.
My pleasure.
All right. Well, Seth's not here for us to pick on him, but I couldn't believe that he's saying it's an issue with the camera. And I don't know, Mark, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, it's not an issue with the camera because, of course, not only were the pilots seeing it visually, it was also picked up on Aegis radar from the ships. So at times we had three separate indicators or three separate bits of data to show that something real was there, you know, in the vicinity of the aircraft and the naval ships. So, of course, it wasn't only wasn't caused by an internal reflection on a camera. You know, the bigger point is that Shostak, I'll pick on him, is just going to the old skeptics routine here, which is it's all misperceptions. I mean, essentially, he's saying it's misperceptions. And how long have we heard that? Yeah. You know, rather than taking it seriously, and here's how you take it seriously without saying that it's, you know, aliens. You say, well, you know, this looks like some evidence that something interesting was observed, and it was seen on radar, and it was seen on visually and all the rest. In other words, you should learn before you start talking. But I don't really think it's aliens. You know, here's reasons X, Y, and Z why it's probably not. But I think the Navy should look into it. Why not? Because maybe it's something from China. Maybe it's something from Russia. Maybe it's something really unknown. But I don't think it's aliens. But there's nothing wrong with looking into it. That's the honest answer to a question about it.
Yeah. Dave, what do you think?
Well, there's so many things that we could, I would say, attack or discuss. He first starts off by stating that this was strangely placed in the Intelligence Authorization Act. Then he goes on to state that I think the military is looking at this from a defense standpoint. And yes, they are. That there's no doubt about that. They've been unequivocal in that statement. Whatever these things are, they could be a potential threat and we need to investigate it. In going with that thought, we need to appropriate funds for said investigations. So it makes sense that you would see it's not strangely placed, as he alludes to. And the other thing I think we need to point out, these videos have been properly vetted by people much more intelligent, much more highly trained than Mr. Shostak, who is an astronomer. He is not an expert on advanced FLIR camera videography. There have been defense experts that have looked at these and have eliminated all of these prosaic explanations. Yet, to Mark's point, he follows the typical scripting where he's just going to say it's misperception. It's a internal reflection of the camera. It's a statement without any merit.
Yes. Yeah.
And can I make a broader
point? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Here's the broader point. And this relates to what SETI is doing now and how SETI is evolving. As probably some of our viewers and listeners know, the SETI has broken out of its paradigm of only looking and listening for radio signals. Mm-hmm. And not only are they looking for light signals as well, optical SETI, they've even now are talking about something called technosignatures. And technosignatures is just what it sounds like. It's technical evidence or physical evidence of alien civilizations, which can be something called a Dyson sphere. It can be other kinds of giant astronomical sized engineering by extraterrestrial civilizations. But it can also be something much closer to home, alien probes, including in the solar system or including mining on the moon. Well, and there are bona fide SETI scientists and researchers talking about those ideas. He'd had a conference about it a year or two ago. And Seth knows that. Well, why can't this be a possible, you know, evidence of something like that? And the answer is, of course it could. So for, but Seth doesn't want to ever give any credence to the UFO phenomenon. And so he therefore won't even, allow the opening, allow this fluorescence now of ideas in the SETI community to affect his thinking.
Right. You know, my thoughts about that, and you both made excellent points, and a couple of things. You know, I mean, they have to get funding. SETI has to get funding. They're never going to want to follow the UFO trail as far as possibly being visited from, you know, extraterrestrial. And the thing that's sad about this whole situation, in my opinion, is here it is, NPR. It's listened to by millions and millions of people that might have had an interest in what these videos are about. And now they're going to listen to Seth and go, oh, well, it's nothing, no bother. And so they won't look further into the topic. I think he kind of killed it for a lot of people that'll consider him an expert. You know, they're talking, NPR is speaking to an expert on this subject. And so there you go. It's too bad they didn't have more than one person's view.
Martin, another comment I'd like to make that he referenced, he stated that there was a plethora of programs in the 50s to investigate this and that this is, quote unquote, nothing new. Well, I disagree fundamentally. We have DOD officials that have come out and stated these UAPs, whatever they are, you fill in the blank, are real.
Yeah.
They did not state that in any of the programs from the 1950s. Quite the contrary. They were trying to poo-poo, downplay, manage public perception. This is new. December of 2017, when that New York Times article came out, and then the subsequent revelations on the part of the Navy, this is a new paradigm that we are in. We are in a different era. It is not a question, are UFOs, UAPs real? The question is, what are they?
Well, when was that that letter published, the early 1947, about these are not fictitious?
The Twining memo.
The fall of 47.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that is almost an admission that they think something's going on all the way back then. But so we've gone in and out of the admissions that something's going on, I guess.
Well, what happened back in 47 was when the UFO problem surfaced, and it was really a UFO problem for the military, what a shock, took it seriously. They looked at the data and they said, well, there's something real here. Effectively what Dave just said, you know, they look at the videos now and they say, well, this is real. The military didn't have videos, but they had good sightings by all kinds of people, including their pilots and others. And they said, well, this is real. So Twining wrote his memo. You know, they started the first Project Sign. And of course, we know the Project Sign group looked at it another 9 months or after that and said, yeah, this is really real. So we have to write an estimate of the situation. You know, this says this could be interplanetary. Only then did things get quashed for reasons we don't, you know, need to get into. But the point is that, yes, they not only had that attitude back then, they had it because they looked at the data objectively. And that's what they concluded.
Yeah, I'm just going to pop that Twining memo up. I think I've loaded the right one. You can't quite read it. But yeah, it is an interesting thing. So I would like, I think we should jump right in and talk about why you're here tonight. Dave, you were real excited a few weeks ago. And another thing, you know, you can trust me because you said, don't tell anyone. But this was coming. So
I'm happy to say that. And there we go. Happy to say that. You know, this is the first public discussion that Mark and I have had with regard to, I think, a huge shift or focus on research and looking at the data, you know, to Mark's point, being objective and looking at the data and more specifically preserving that data. What you see there in the photo, actually, I'll let Mark, I think Mark should have the honor of describing what we're seeing there. Mark's been pivotal in making this happen, but I think Mark should be the one to describe, you know, what has taken place recently.
Sure. Go ahead, Mark.
Go ahead, Martin. Yeah. Oh yeah. So on the right, what you see, and they have only been seen by a few people over the years, only because not many people came to the CUPO's offices, are the center case file cabinets lined up there. I don't know if you can see all 15 or so, Dave, but those are the files, cabinets that house our gigantic collection of original UFO reports from all possible sources, including Blue Book material, even originals that Alan Hynek managed to unleash from the Blue Book files at Wright-Patterson, and then cases from NICAP, because, of course, we house the NICAP archives, and of course, our own case files that we got from reports that came to the center and other sources, overseas sources, APRO files, and on and on and on, and clippings and all that. And so these case files now reside because of the wonderful services and offer to host these for reasons we'll get into in Albuquerque at Dave's research room.
Wow. Dave, you're going to have to get a bigger boat.
I actually used that exact quote after we finally had all of these delivered. To my surprise, though, I actually, as Mark will attest in some of the discussions we had, I wasn't sure if we could even accommodate it. But to my surprise, this is like the TARDIS from Doctor Who. It just seems like, you know, it's a dimension that you walk into and there's just ample space to be afforded for these files.
That's good, because the next truck is loading up now.
hey, Mark, Dave, will these actually also go to the university?
Well, that's to be determined. To be clear, you know, Mark and Kufos own the files. I'm simply curating them at this time. And really, the purpose of that, Mark, if I can jump to what we're going to be doing in 2021, the focus is the digitization of all of these files for A, long-term preservation, but B, wider accessibility, if you will. And that's to be determined, how, you know, as far as how that will be hosted, how that would take place. But, you know, as Mark has alluded to many times over the years, if you want to see the files, you got to come to the files. And yeah. So the goal is to get these digitized, preserved. God forbid if anything happened to the originals, we still retain the data. And then obviously once it's digital, it can be shared and distributed and made accessible on a much wider scale, essentially worldwide, depending on how we would host the data. But that's the goal in a nutshell. And, you know, Mark and I are here today, but I was talking this morning with Jan Aldridge. Jan Aldridge and Barry Greenwood are going to be making long-term trips out here, as I think we've discussed previously, Martin, privately. And they're going to be essentially, my wife and I are going to be hosting them at our home and allowing them to stay here so they can do literally day in, day out scanning of the files in the hopes that, as Mark and I have discussed, hopefully maybe in the next 2 to 3 years, we'll look back on this and all the files will be finally digitized.
Yeah, the background is that Jan and Barry, are wonderful efforts here, volunteer efforts, have been scanning the files, and we're about one third of the way through.
Wow.
But due to a variety of circumstances here in the Chicago area, that couldn't continue here. And so we were casting about for, you know, knowing it has to get done, you know, how are we going to make this happen? And, you know, one thing led to another, and I've been talking to Dave on some other projects, and then he offered the services there. And Jan and Barry said, oh, great, you know, we don't mind. We'll be happy to go to Albuquerque just as well as Chicago to do this. And so, you know, that's the plan. And if it wasn't for the pandemic, the process would have picked up already and be continuing. And what we're hoping to do is that, as Dave said, do it a little quicker than we had been doing it. It was a slow process because they weren't coming for too long. They were coming for one visit every year, basically for a couple of weeks. And so we hope it's going to be enhanced. And in fact, we'll get to how we're hoping to do that. So yes. And the goal is, you know, MUFON has scanned all their case files too, when they're in the processes of redacting them and hopefully making it somehow available. But I don't think they have any firm plans about when and if it would be available to the public. Our goal all along has been to make these available within reason, you know, to be defined to anybody, because this is a resource, you know, not just for the UFO community. This is a public resource that should be available, you know, to anybody who wants to use these files, because that's the point of it, is to make them available for research, investigation, what have you.
If I had to ask you to guess how many files are involved, papers involved, I should say,
right. Pages. The best way to think about it, we've never counted the cases, and I always throw out 100,000, but it's 15 filing cabinets. You know, they're five drawer. They're standard large office cabinets, and they're basically, chocked full, some too full of paper. Right. So that's how much there is, whatever that ends up at.
Wow. Yeah.
And Martin, major undertaking. I always like to clarify, we talk about the CUFOS files, but to be clear, CUFOS was founded in 1973. I like to clarify that CUFOS also inherited the NICAP files, which go back.
I heard him say that. Wow.
And more specifically, a somewhat less well-known organization, but nonetheless extremely instrumental in gathering data, especially in the 1950s, is a CSI New York, Civilian Saucer Intelligence. So when we say the CUFOS files, it's kind of like Blue Book. We say Blue Book, but we also mean Project Sign, Project Grudge. When we talk CUFOS, we're talking about three significant sets of data.
And more than that, there's the Australian Center for UFO Studies files. We have lots and lots of them that they sent over to us. And, of course, foreign case files as well.
And the Blue Book material, as you mentioned, Mark.
Yes, and the Blue Book material. We have, they're on microfilm. We know that there's Blue Book microfilms. But we also know that the microfilms don't have everything. Right. So we have, paper copies, flimsy carbon copies. And we have a few things that, quite frankly, may not be in the Blue Book files because Heine took it with him and somehow never managed to get it back to Wright Pat. And we could go on and on. And then there's the clippings, which is a whole, separate thing that goes with things. And there's an extensive – we don't have as extensive a collection as Barry Greenwood does, the King of Clippings. No one has more than that. But we have a pretty good set.
Yeah. Now, what about photographs? I mean, are there some – are there some notable photographs in this lot?
We do have photographs, but surprisingly, we have fewer than you would expect. Of course, we have some. But what we have more of are witness interviews on tape.
Oh, wow.
And they are not at Dave's house, sadly. Dave has kept, every day I get an email. When are the tapes coming? No, I'm sorry. But in my basement, in my research room, are boxes and boxes of audio tapes, including reel to reel. They go back that far.
Yeah, those can be digitized even easier, actually.
Well, yes, I was just going to say, right behind my computer here, I've got my sound studio essentially where we can digitize cassette reel to reel. And I've been doing that for a number of years, kind of in the tradition of Wendy Connors, right, Mark?
That's right. And we have digitized the same thing. We've digitized some, but, there's only so much time in the day, and more importantly, only so many volunteers, to do the work. So, but yes, it's also on the it's on the agenda.
Wendy Connors, is that the one that did the faded discs?
She did, and yes. She actually resided here in Albuquerque, ironically enough.
How about that? I have a blog up on my website. I just put up, republished it because it was taken away when I was hacked a year ago. But anyway, that's up there now about the faded discs with all the archives you can get to. Those are fantastic, that she did that. So here's a question up from Rob. Are there any plans to digitize the data for analysis?
Yes, we want to do two things. First, we want to, when we scan the files, create PDFs and make them searchable and try to create a website that makes that easy enough to do, even though that is, if you can imagine, is a huge undertaking as well.
Yes.
But secondly, yes, we want to create a database where we've extracted information from the files let people use it. That's a whole separate project, because what does it mean to extract information? What does it mean to digitize information? That could be almost a whole show, quite frankly, because people like Jacques Vallée, who thought a lot about databases over the years, have said, you should create an electronic database, not just have PDF files. But everything should be the original words of the witness. Okay, so the data should be digitized, so it's really easy to work with. But it should be, if a witness had a thousand word statement, those thousand words should be there, along with other information. Other people would say, create a coded database, right, where you know, you code things like this is what the UFO size was and this is what the shape was. And so if the witness describes in 50 words what the disc looked like, but you can code it in three categories, then you just code it in three categories. That's way downstream, of course, about, you know, how to handle the data. But that's absolutely it. When I said, you know, what's our long-term goal? You know, that is a goal. It's to make the information available in a variety of formats so people can readily use it.
So right now, if I was just any Joe Schmo UFO investigator, that has a nice ring to it. and I contacted you and said, hey, I want to search this case. Do you have any information about this case? I bet you know a lot of what you have already. But when it comes to this new collection of files,
it's a huge learning curve. And and I actually have already received a number of requests. I mean, even prior to the files being transferred here, I was remarking to Mark last year that, you know, my wife and I will pull information that I have on various cases. I you know, periodically get requests for this, that, and the other thing. And am more than happy to, you know, if it's not too voluminous in size, to scan it and send it to them. And then in absence of that, I've had researchers come and visit and spend a day or spend a weekend just researching, scanning, making photocopies here in the research room of the material that I had. But now certainly, you know, that opportunity is now afforded with regard to, you know, the KUFOS files. There's just that much more data here for people to peruse.
Yeah. How do you spend any time with your wife?
I do. Actually, it's funny you say that. And Mark's met my wife, Kendra. Sunday afternoon, we were actually sitting here in the research room. I was going through the files looking for triangular UFO reports from the 50s and 60s. And she was sitting here, which is a nice segue, actually. She was sitting in this very chair, and off camera is a digitization machine for microfilm. And so she is focused on digitizing microfilm, which, as I said, nice segue. In addition to the material that Mark sent, Jan Aldridge sent approximately 200 reels of microfilm with thousands and thousands of pages of documents. Some of that is extremely rare material per Jan and per Barry Greenwood. There's about 32, 33 rolls of news clipping service that the Air Force subscribed to during the summer wave of 52. And again, per Jan Aldridge, he stated that stuff's never been digitized or made widely available. And interestingly enough, in talking to Barry, the only reason that we have this material today is a writer went to Wright Patterson Air Force Base to talk to Hector Quintanilla, who was in charge of Blue Book at the time, and he was writing an article on how the media addresses the UFO subject. And so he thought, well, I'll start with, you know, Hector Quintanilla at Blue Book. He went in and was waiting for Quintanilla, who was actually running late. And while he was waiting for him to show up, he was looking at these boxes sitting on top of some file cabinets in the kind of the common area. And Quintanilla comes in and apologizes for his tardiness. And he goes, oh, that's all right. I was just admiring these boxes you have up here on the file cabinet. He goes, oh, those are actually old news clippings. We subscribed to a news clipping service in 52 and we had microfilmed them, but we were getting ready to throw those away. Would you be interested in them? Jeez. And the gentleman said, of course. He goes, that's actually why I'm here. I'm focused on how the media looks at the UFO subject. This is right up my alley. So decades later, Barry Greenwood came in touch with this individual and essentially was able to take possession. And now we have copies here.
Oh, that's awesome. Hey, this is something I don't think I've ever heard of this. Any pyramids? Do people ever report pyramid-shaped craft?
Not many, but I have come across some, actually, in the literature.
I've seen a few, too, yes.
Yeah.
What's that, Mark?
I've seen a few, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Almost any. I've seen hexagon-shaped UFOs reported.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I talk about on this. I have a friend that saw one that was shaped like a square box.
Yeah. Square boxes. Usually rectangles are not uncommon, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bizarre stuff. So, yeah. So let's see. When these are going to you, Dave, does that mean you stop everything you're basically doing and you kind of switch over to this? I mean, you're always doing something in those rooms.
Yeah, I feel kind of like I'm a schizophrenic multitasker. I mean, my mind
comes in handy. Yeah.
Different realms, and I'm moving in different directions all at the same time. No, I'm still doing some historical research, but I'm, to your point, Martin, trying to acquaint myself with the material that is here so that when people do come, I can maybe help direct them a little bit better in that sense as kind of as the curator, if you will. No, I'm still involved in my historical research and still, you know, working and trying to familiarize myself with what's here. And then again, working also on microfilm. I mean, what's interesting about this is, and I'm sure Mark will back me up on this, there is no shortage of data in this field. And yeah. Sometimes I think there's a false narrative that's put out. And by that, I mean production companies. I can't tell you how many times I've been approached by production companies and they say, well, we're going to cover this case, and this case. It's the same three or four cases that six other production companies have covered. And, you know, as Mark was alluding to, there's a lot of case files here, cases people have never even heard of. And I would even argue probably some that are just as credible, if not more credible, than some of the more popularized cases that we hear about ad infinitum, ad nauseum on these shows.
Yeah, right. I mean, most production companies will come and not say, tell me about better cases. In fact, right. Yeah. The insight to say, you know, everybody else has covered the Kelly Hopkinsville case or something. So have you got another creature case that's not Kelly Hopkinsville? And the answer is yes, we do.
Yes.
But they don't ask that question. No.
Right.
Wow. I was watching an interview. My friend Lee Spiegel was being interviewed by this young girl, a singer or whatever for like her YouTube channel. Her name was Elephant, something like that. And she says to him, did you ever have you ever seen a UFO? And he goes, yes. And then she goes, and do other people you know have? He didn't even ask anything about the UFO sighting. And I think that was just such a funny thing how people can just, they're so focused on these, you know, these strange things that they don't even think about.
Yeah. Yeah. Lee had his sighting in Lumberton, North Carolina, 1975. And as Mark will attest, we have the case file right here.
Oh, how about that? So Adam wants to know, are there any old film or video clips? We asked about, pictures, but what about
right. Of course, Hynek got a lot of stuff over the years, and a lot of the films and things went with him to Arizona, actually. Mm-hmm. And didn't stay in the case files.
Yeah.
So other films, the original things went to a guy named Fred Beckman, who was at the University of Chicago and was part of the original Invisible College that people have heard about with Alan Hynek and Jacques Vallée in Chicago. And Fred didn't always return stuff to the center files, to be brutally frank. The quick answer is no. But it's also here's what's also true. When you think back to the old days, right, back meaning the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and you say, what, you know, are there, you know, where are the great, you know, are there 50 films of UFOs and 100 great photos and, you know, whatever? And the answer is, you know, no, there aren't as many as you'd like to see, right? You know, Ballester Olmos from Spain, you know, has a whole research project and PhotoCat, as he calls it. And the number of great photos, there's lots of photos, right? There's lots of photos that are, you know, either hoaxes or just not showing anything because it was a spot there or something. But the number of great photos is relatively small. This, by the way, has been previously, it was a criticism by the skeptics and debunkers of the field, which is, well, if these things are real, why aren't there more photos? You know, forget films. Films was tough, right? Having a movie camera with you.
Yeah.
But why aren't there more films? The answer back then was simple, and it was summarized by an actual quote from a witness that in an article that was published in Flying Saucer Review, which is a British publication. And this was a French case. And the witness had a UFO up close, close encounter of the first kind, had a camera in their car. And the investigator said, sir, you had a camera. You know, the UFO was there for a few minutes. You didn't take a photo. He said, I could have been standing on a pile of cameras, and I wouldn't have thought of taking a photo.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I totally get that. I understand that. You're involved in the moment because it's like you can't believe what you're seeing. I understand that.
I think the British term gobsmacked really hits the nail on the head, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the cases in these files that came there. Can you talk about any significant cases that someone would actually see in these?
First of all, even though we did just talk about some of the, well-known cases everybody talks about, there are extensive files on the well-known cases because Alan Hynek was Alan Hynek. And that means that either he was involved in the case, like the Pascagoula case, the Hill case, et cetera. So we've got, original material. And by the way, on some of the well-known cases, we have scanned it. It is on the CUFOS website, CUFOS.org. You can go there and you'll see some famous case files, and every document is there for you to look at right now. So we have extensive files on Kelly Hopkinsville as well. That's because of not Alan, but because of the investigators that worked with Dr. Hynek. So we've got that there, right? Okay. And as Dave said, we've got obscure cases, right, that nobody's ever heard of that would make, but they're rich and all that, like vehicle interference files, right? So, that was my first claim to fame in the field, was studying cases where, cars were stopped by UFOs. And my monograph came out in 1981. We already had a fairly extensive set, but I went searching for more of them, contacting colleagues around the world. And so we have the largest original set of reports, on that. And by the way, there's a good example of how the difficulty and the quality of UFO case investigations, because we're all volunteers. So, you would think on a vehicle interference case, wouldn't the investigator write down the make, model, and gear of the car involved? And the answer is they didn't always do that. But on the other hand, if you had a Ray Fowler, a fantastic investigator, if you had a Keith Basterfield or Bill Chalker from Australia or Jenny Randalls from the UK, and then again, others whose names go on, then you'll have very extensive file on the case. In fact, on some of them, you'll have magnetic testing to see whether the metal body of the car was magnetized differently than a standard car of that make and model. And in a few instances, that research was done, just like the Condon Project did. So there's a wide variety of those. But anyway, that's a short, semi-short answer to your question, Martin.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I've been in touch with Ray Fowler, and he will not be on the show because he has an issue with hearing. So he said he just wouldn't feel comfortable. And he lives about 50 miles away from where I live. He lives in Kennebunk, Maine. Anyway, he has a new book that came out, and it's called UFOs, the ultimate abduction. And it's basically whether they're psychological or physical. I think that's what he's wrapping up his career in writing to give this his observation. But yeah, he was a great, great researcher. Still going.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I've seen a lot of Ray's investigation reports in the files, and I think Mark brings up a really valid point. You not only learn about the UFO sightings, but you learn, I think, a little bit more about the investigators, the researchers, to Mark's point. Some were extremely diligent in documenting and investigating. And, for those that may already appreciate Ray, like myself, you start going through these files, your appreciation goes up several notches when you see the work that they've done. And I might add, over decades. I mean, seeing the longevity of some of these investigators and researchers, as I always say when I do my lectures, we stand on the shoulder of giants, we meaning myself. I stand on the shoulder of those that were able to do the time and the diligence to collect this data, without which we wouldn't have a field. And that's something, Martin, I know we've talked about that on the show as well as personally. There's so much conjecture, speculation, belief with regard to this subject. At the end of the day, this is what it's all based on: data, raw reports, information, data sets. Without this, we have nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, there's something really to be said about, well, about you too. For one, you don't do this for money. You do this. It's all about you're volunteering your time, and it's these, your work is what puts the field ahead, and, you know, preserving these files and all that. Not someone out there that's, you know, trying to go on the speaker mode or whatever to try to, you know, to cash in on. No one's really making a lot any money on the field. No. There's a little misconception about that.
No, and it's funny you bring this up, and I'll mention this to you in the audience, because I've conveyed this to Mark. I think, was it last year, Mark, that I don't want to be one of those researchers that's just lecturing to lecture, because I know there are some that do it for a living. At the same time, though, you bring up a good point. If I just sit on this data and I, you know, run it through my head and I try to find correlations in the data, what's the point? That's selfish. If I'm just doing it for my own edification, at some point you want to share that information, and, you know, through vehicles like your show right now, being able to talk about this project that we're going to be undertaking and or continuing to undertake, I should say, without, you know, books or mediums to convey that information. I mean, we do need to get the information out there. But as I've told Mark, you know, I try to walk that fine line. I'm not cranking out a new book every 6 months. I'm not, you know, online spinning the latest conspiracy tale. If I feel I have valid data, I will present it. If I don't, I will not.
We have some questions coming in from the other chat room over at KGRA radio. And let's see, is there any possibility after rummaging through these files that at some point, either Mark or David or other individuals, for example, can display and discuss on a video platform? Well, I'm glad they brought that up, because I do plan on coming out there.
Yeah.
And when I do, we're going to get some people together and we're going to be on video and we're going to be doing some of that. I don't know how much we can actually show on video, but I think she's also meaning, well, could it be part of a video platform, like maybe a TV series or something like that? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I'm looking at the question. That may be what it's saying, because like I've said, if you want to look at some of the files right now, just go to our website and you'll see original documents. But if it's an ongoing series, which is probably what it sounds like, whether it's, you know, video or something, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Yeah. Another question from over there. How much of these files are related to military, law enforcement, or what society would view as credible sources?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, a good percentage. I mean, you know, what does that mean? It means less than 50%, but, you know, more than 5% or 10, you know, somewhere closer to 10% than 50, because we write the Blue Book files and other military sightings are in there, or police and so forth. But nevertheless, as we know with all UFO sightings, the majority does come from the public. Maybe good, you know, respectable types of, you know, science professors, and that they're in there. You know, that's that. By the way, you know, Dave and I are bouncing back and forth on this. I mean, I can recall, don't ask me the exact details and all that, but, you know, there are letters in there to Hynek for us from, yes, science professors or people, chemistry people in industry and all that, saying, well, I can't, you know, I can't actually use my name. I can't do whatever. But, you know, this is what I saw. You know, maybe it was 20 years before that, and they finally felt that they could, you know, write about it. But with a nice detailed description of what they saw, because they're an educated person. And even if the case isn't investigated, that's the key. I mentioned this earlier. You know, most UFO cases are not investigated. First, because most cases aren't even reported.
Right.
But one of the ones that are reported, if you report them 10 or 15 years after the fact, and it was interesting, but, you know, it is what it is. How many organizations, whether it's MUFON, KUFOS, APRA, or whoever, can really go back and investigate it in detail? You know, we know the answer, can't do it. But if you read an account from an intelligent person and say, oh, that's pretty impressive from somebody like that. You know, for example, Mike Swords on our board. Yeah. A lot of people know that name here. Yeah. You know, retired professor at Western Michigan University. He and his brother had a sighting when he was about 20 years old from home in the daylight of a disc. Close at hand. No problem seeing it. But what makes it even more impressive is other people were seeing it at the same time and calling into a radio station.
Nice. Wow.
You know, now, that sighting wasn't investigated. You know, it was back in 1960 or so. It was, you know, there wasn't, as far as I know, Mike didn't report it at the time to any group, and I'm not even sure who was around in West Virginia to investigate it. But when I hear that, you know, yeah, I can't go to the National Academy of Sciences with it. But when I hear that from people like Mike and others calling in, I go, well, yeah, there was something there. And it wasn't a plane and it wasn't a misperception. It was something real they were viewing.
Probably that's what got him started, perhaps.
Yeah. He was already interested, like a lot of people. But certainly, in fact, what it did was it cemented his interest in the subject and it convinced him that it was real. We did a survey of our readers many years ago, like in the mid 90s, of our magazine, International UFO Reporter. And we asked them, what got you interested in this? And about half of them said their own sighting. And that doesn't mean, right, that 50% of the people in the country have a sighting. What it means is when you have a sighting, you become convinced this thing is real. And then you piques your interest. And so those people are more likely to join a group and get involved somehow.
That's exactly why I'm here. You know, I would have never been here if I would not be here right now if I didn't have a sighting.
Yeah. I'm the odd one out, by the way. Never had a sighting.
That's, you know, I like people that have never had a sighting that are investigating this because you don't need to have one. You know, I've talked before about someone in this field that invented a childhood sighting that was on my show that told me he never had a sighting and now he's had a sighting. They're embellishing their past. You don't have to have a sighting to do really great work in this. And, you know, like Dave said earlier, you're building it on the shoulders of the people in front of you, you know, ahead of you.
Yeah, I got interested in UFOs. Like I said, when I grew up in the era when there were sightings that were in the newspaper and they were reported on radio. I mean, people, what happened with the New York Times in 2017, 3 years ago, we know what it was like. And that is nobody reports on UFO sightings. But back then, UFO sightings were in the newspaper. Mind-boggling when you think about it now. So I was interested along with a friend of mine. And I began to read the books that were available, which were, you know, not good for the most part, because my library didn't have Amy Michelle's book. It had George Adamski's book and so forth. But when I got more seriously interested, and for me, that was like fifth or sixth grade, I didn't want to become a ufologist because what was that? I wanted to become an astronomer, which is why I got my bachelor's degree in astrophysics. But what I did do was approach the UFO subject exactly as I approached astrophysics, which is it's a scientific problem to be investigated. And of course, I didn't quite think that, you know, exactly that way as a you know, in sixth grade. But as I grew older, I said, well, UFOs are just like anything else in science, with one exception I'll get to in 2 seconds. But they're just like anything else in science. I'm interested in the galaxies and the stars and the planets. I'm interested in UFOs. It's the same problem. The exception is this. I've done a lot of different scientific studies in my career, and I shifted over to the social sciences, and now I'm working in clinical research and medicine. There is nothing harder to do than study UFOs. Everything else is much easier than studying UFOs by far.
It's so evasive. You know, I mean, it's so by chance that you'd actually, you know, people actually have these sightings for one thing.
Right.
Nothing you can capture and with solid evidence, it's evading. We have this question up, and this is for Dave. But Dave, I think you answered this, didn't you, earlier? Did you find any triangles from the 1950s?
Yes. And again, I've just begun really starting to go through the files in the last month or so. I found a number of those, which I've actually posted on Facebook recently. There were a number of them from specifically 1957. Hazleton, Pennsylvania was one. I also found one from 65 over Puget Sound, which was in a newspaper article. And it was interesting. I looked at that and I did a little bit of research, just cursory review of Puget Sound. And interestingly enough, 1965 was the first year that they started doing maintenance on nuclear naval vessels. So I'm not saying that there's a connection there, but we know historically there does seem to be some type of correlation with nuclear weapons, nuclear storage areas, nuclear, you know, vehicles, nuclear submarines and such. So I found that to be interesting. So yes, I'm finding a number of those from the 50s and actually several from the 60s. I just found one this morning, actually. And so, you know, they always say the truth is out there. Well, I say the truth is in here. And there's so much data to go through, as Mark will attest. And it's exciting as well, because I don't think Mark and I touched on this. The CUFOS files are cataloged chronologically. And in absence of having a quote-unquote database to use, it's interesting if you find an interesting case file, because in the context of time, you can see what else was being reported either nationwide or worldwide around that same time frame. So it at least gives you some temporal context, if you will.
I see. Well, we're ready to go into break. And when we come back, I would like to talk to you in detail, because we do have a lot of new listeners, about some of the cases. And then eventually we're going to get into more contemporary cases and take calls in the last half hour. So we're ready to go into break. And right now I'm going to play a clip during the break here on YouTube with J. Allen Hynek, and Rod Serling is presenting him. So hang in, everyone. We'll be right back right after these messages over at KGR Radio.
The CIA now would enter the picture by convening a panel of top scientists to examine the UFO phenomenon. The CIA's concern was that recent waves of sightings might constitute a threat to our national security. The thinking was that the enemy could exploit UFOs as a decoy in the preparation for an attack on the United States. Five outstanding scientists and various Air Force and CIA representatives were to meet on Wednesday, January 14, 1953. Among the panel members was one associate member who was destined to have more experience with the UFO phenomena than any other American scientist to date, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, astrophysicist and head of the astronomy department of Northwestern University.
I was called into the meeting on Thursday. The panel members were seated around this table. It was a rather somber and impressive occasion, actually. I was a junior member, and I remember feeling considerably nervous and apprehensive about being in front of this powerhouse of scientists. But then, for the past 4 years, I had been scientific advisor to the U.S. Air Force on this very problem. There were two films that were of particular interest to the panel at that time. One was a film taken by a Navy officer while on vacation in Utah, near Tremonton, Utah, and the other was a film taken in Great Falls, Montana, by the owner of the local baseball team. The Utah film had already been subjected to some 1,000 or so man-hours of analysis by the Navy's Photographic Interpretation Laboratory. So the panel got up from their chairs and crouched around the wall to examine the films, and they asked to have the films run several times, as a matter of fact. Now, the Navy had, on the basis of their detailed analysis of the Utah films, they had concluded that the objects shown in the films could not be birds, balloons, aircraft, and so forth, but indeed that they were self-luminous, unidentified objects. Despite this conclusion, the panel rejected it and concluded that the objects were birds. They couldn't be unidentified, therefore they had to be birds. I came away from the meeting and from the room with the distinct feeling, however, that the panel had deliberately moved to debunk the whole subject and not to give it the serious scientific attention which it deserved.
All right. Welcome back to the show. My guests this evening, we have Mark Rodiger and David Marler. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Hi again.
Love that that old clip of J. Allen Hynek. A little blurry, but still a lot of fun.
Nice to see him. I still miss him after all this time.
Everyone that talks about him all say the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, are you in touch? Have you ever talked to Jay and the not Jay, Paul?
Paul. I am still in touch with the family. So sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're great.
I knew Paul. I knew Paul when he was this tall, running around the house doing crazy stuff like kids do.
Yeah. He talks about the story of he answered the phone when Hickson
Parker.
Yeah, Calvin Parker called. He answered the phone and wrote it on the chalkboard, like he remembered it. And
the whole family was involved in a way, just because you had to be involved in the sense that people came to the house regularly because the house often served as the center. The center had its office in several spots over the years, and part of the time it was his house on the third floor. I'm sorry, second floor. And so people would naturally show up at the house. Father Gill from the famous, Gill sighting came to the house where I met him, and we sat in the living room and talked. And so, Mimi served her, hors d'oeuvres, it was great fun in every possible way back then.
Yeah. I remember Paul was talking about Father Gill. So anyone that hasn't heard about that case, it's really, really interesting. You can Google it. And it was quite a sighting where there was interaction between some type of beings on top of a craft with a interaction with a flashlight. Really.
Multiple witness case. Yeah.
Many, many witnesses, right? Aren't there a lot?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, several witnesses over a long period of time, long enough that basically it's either what they said it is or they're making it up completely because there's no alternative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you know the basic details? Do you want to talk again? We do have a lot of new listeners that are just curious about cases that have never heard them before. I don't know any of the deep details, but I mean, I'm asking you to wing it here if you happen to know a lot about that case.
The Gill case?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I don't know. Yeah, it was, I think, 58. Dave, maybe you can. I don't know if it was 58 or 59, but it was, one of those 2 years, I believe. Mm-hmm. And Martin, you could quickly Google it and find out. But essentially, this is in Papua New Guinea, where Father Gill, the Reverend Gill, actually Reverend, I said Father, but Reverend Gill, was there, missionarying to the natives, the classic, thing that people do, except it wasn't the middle of the jungle and it wasn't, man eating or, cannibals. But and he was at a mission school and all that stuff. But on an evening, somebody came running into and said, there's something out here that's unusual. Let's take a look. And so Gil went out. They're very good. There he is. And saw, and this is a great that, you can leave it up for a second, Martin, if you would, so I can describe it. So this artist impression is accurate enough. So you have the Gil and the natives, and there were several, standing there watching a dish-shaped object, a fairly classic dish-shaped object, not with a dome, but with kind of a rounded raised area, on the top, and it was lit and there was a light beam coming from it at times. That's good enough, right? And it wasn't too high. I don't know, 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet, somewhere in that range, and sitting there moving around a little bit. But then figures came out onto this raised area where there were railings and looked down at them. And yes, at some point there appeared to be contact between the group on the ground and the group on the flying saucer. We can use the word flying saucer in this case, can't we? That's a little more stylized, but it captures the thing. And, that is what was reported. There were sightings on other days but this was the main sighting seen by lots of people, seen over a long, how long a period of time was it? 45 minutes, Dave, something like that.
At least, I believe, Mark.
Yeah. And it was dusk and then it got to be darker. But the point is that, if you stand and watch something for 45 minutes, it's 2,000 feet up in the air. You can pretty much tell right there that what it was like. And there you go. This is his drawing. He was a good enough artist. That's what they saw. And you tell me what that was if it wasn't what it appears to be.
Yeah, 45 minutes. I've had that's amazing that it lasted so long.
59. You know? Yeah, I know it was 58 or 59. So
59.
We won't go into the crazy skeptics, explanations about what it could have been, because, you know, they're all crazy. but on the other hand, it happened in Papua New Guinea, of all places, meaning there is no on-site investigation. You know, Dr. Hynek, because he went everywhere, and I'm not exaggerating, went there, like in the early 70s or something, when he went on a trip to Australia and said, I'd like to go there too. So, of course, he did. But that didn't help. So no on-site investigation was done. But you have this, the man of the cloth witnessing this, along with other people whose statements were taken and some other corroborating stuff about sightings at the time. So it's thought of as a fabulous case because of those things. If you're looking for fabulous cases that are investigated, well, it wasn't in the way that Ray Fowler would do it, but there you go.
Yeah. And this question up here, how can they be on the outside of the craft? Not the only one. There's other cases where people have talked about, well, for instance, in the Ariel school incident, some of them claim that they were or was standing on top of the craft, which is pretty strange. It is strange.
Yeah, it is strange. And we know that the behavior of UFOs itself, the objects, and then the behavior of the entities is a word I like to use, associated with the objects at times, maybe more than at times, is strange. And it is the kind of thing that is confusing. It's the kind of thing that makes people like Jacques Vallée come up with esoteric theories about what's going on, because, in fact, yes, the behaviors don't make sense to us. Like the case in Belgium where a guy's motorcycle was stopped by a UFO. At least, it stopped in the presence of a UFO, and an entity came toward him that seemed a little bit like possibly a robot or not, and walked up to him, and this guy was, as you imagine, totally frightened, and handed him what appeared to be a piece of chocolate. and then walked away back to the UFO, which had landed on the ground. So, yes, that's confusing, isn't it? So standing on the outside of the UFO, quite frankly, is fairly tame. How could they physically do it? This is just a UFO hovering in space. It wasn't moving violently around when they were standing there. So, you and I could have stood there, if we had a railing to hang on to.
Yeah, yeah. And when the thing moved back and forth with the flashlight, that is really something, really interesting. Yeah, I remember I was talking to Greg Bishop about, cases. And one of the things he said was someone said they drove by and they saw, there was a teddy bear in plaid on the porch. And he said, no, wait a minute. That's important. It's unusual. He says anything that's really odd, write it down, document it. It doesn't make any sense, but there's so many things when people are talking about UFO cases that absolutely make no sense.
Well, conversely, Martin, if I might just use that as a springboard, I've come across about three reports recently, and by recently, I mean in the last 3 to 4 weeks, of people shooting at UFOs. And of course, we've heard these cases before, but some of these were relatively obscure that I had not heard about. And Mark probably knows more since he has insight into what's in those files.
Well, yeah, there's the famous one from North Dakota that occurred during the Blue Book era. So Alan Hynek did look into it.
Yeah. And there was one from 64, right around the time of Socorro here in Edgewood, New Mexico, which is on the other side of the Sandia Mountains from where I am at right now. And a gentleman shot at a UFO. And so I was thinking, Mark, rather humorously, one could almost do a whole lecture just on the weird reactions that humans have regarding UFOs, i.e. shooting at them.
Sure. It doesn't surprise me, probably any of us, right, that over the years that a few people would, who had a gun handy would do something like that. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Martin.
I was just going to say that's the last thing I would do. I can't imagine. What were some of the reactions?
Well, the thing about the North Dakota case, and again, because we had, I hadn't planned for this, I don't want to go into extensive details, but essentially, a guy sees, a landed UFO. It was a landed UFO, and there were an entity or two outside. I think maybe only one entity, and he decided, even though it was an entity, he didn't shoot at the UFO. He shot at the entity. I think they were hunters. Coming back to me, there were two hunters, I think, out, and they saw this. And when he did that, one of the entities shouted at them, "Why'd you do that?"
In English?
In English. And but then they did not appear to be injured. They got back in the UFO, and it took off.
Wow. Now, they are from the future.
Yeah. Well, right. Or we also know this, that, and again, make of it what you will. Communication goes on between the entities and humans in a variety of ways. Telepathically, right? But also verbally. And it's not typically verbal stuff that makes no sense at all, like me trying to understand Chinese. No, it's something in your own language. And that's the other thing about, we always have to keep in mind that the UFO phenomena is truly international. And, because of that, I've been having colleagues, as Dr. Hynek did, around the whole world for many, many years, way before the internet. We were talking to people all over the world or writing them. And because we recognize that the phenomena is worldwide. Well, when UFOs entities communicate to people overseas, they don't use English, of course, when those cases occur. They use a language that where they can communicate with. So sure, he's in North Dakota. I don't know if it had a North Dakota accent, but other than that, the guy's going to speak English.
Yeah, that's crazy. And Dave, can you talk a little bit? You were on Russian news today, right?
Yes, came up rather abruptly. This was nothing scheduled, but I received an email this morning, and it was, let me make sure I get the RTVI, and they had contacted me, and they were wanting to discuss the recent Intelligence Authorization Act for fiscal year 2021, and they really just wanted to talk about UFOs in general as well. And so it was rather interesting. It was, live news in Russian. And I had my Russian translator there kind of serving as the intermediary. And it was really nice to engage that audience because, to Mark's point, it's an international phenomena. And it's just great to be able to be afforded that opportunity to reach out or to engage, a Russian audience, and not just Russia, but they're, on the internet, they're essentially worldwide. They're one of the largest news outlets for Russian speaking people. And wow. So it's just great when we have those rare opportunities like that to kind of bridge those gaps and be able to try to share information.
I've been to Russia a number of times, and I was there once for a couple of months and communicating with someone in the Ural Mountains. I was trying to get him on the show, but we spoke on the phone and it wasn't going to work. His English was, he can just barely, get by, but, right. It takes a little extra time with a translator, doesn't it?
it does. And, it's something I don't think we touched on earlier with regard to the Kufos files. There's a lot of foreign reports in there, Kufos was based in Chicago, but through Blue Book and other sources, there's a number of, foreign reports for almost every given year. And so it's not just a national, but there's an international flavor to those reports as well.
Yeah. This is geared toward you more than to Mark, I don't know, maybe for Mark too, but because of the induction of the other files you mentioned that they have, not just their files, but other files. Has there been any cases that you're aware of that either one of you have looked through that all of a sudden there's new information that was never available before? And like, oh my God, I didn't know this existed, that type of thing. Has there been anything like that?
Not specific to the Kufos files, but I was going through some of my files recently. And I just had this conversation with another researcher the other day. I brought this up. It was one of the original interviews with Jesse Marcel Sr. And it was a transcript. It was some of Bob Pratt's material that I had gotten copies of. And it was one of the early interviews with Marcel before he had done a lot of the TV interviews. And I was shocked that in the course of the interview, he describes a UFO sighting he had right there in Roswell. And he described a V formation of lights very similar to the famous Lubbock Lights case. And he doesn't go into a lot of detail, but I've got the transcript from the recorded interview, the audio recorded interview, which Bob would often do. I've got lots of his interviews, the transcripts. And I've never read that anywhere. I've never heard that anywhere. And Mark probably, you know, with his knowledge already had heard about it or had read it. But that was news to me. I didn't realize Jesse Marcel Sr. had a UFO sighting. And again, whatever it was it a flock of geese, you know, that reflecting lights? I don't know. I'm not saying, you know, how valid it was insofar as a quote unquote UFO, but I just had never heard that anywhere before.
Wow. What about you, Mark? Anything you can think of?
Let me segue off it because that's a broad area of, you know, did I find a case where, you know, something else popped up? But let me say that, and I saw a question also on the chat area semi-related to this. What can we do with these old files? You know, what are the many things we can do with them besides scan them and digitize them? Well, the answer is we can go back and look at them, and first we can contact the witness. People don't do much follow-up on UFO cases and say, what is this person thinking now about their sighting 20 years ago? You know, particularly if they had a close encounter. Also, and this is perhaps even more important, are they having any medical problems if they had a close encounter, right? Mm-hmm. Then no, you know, again, we know why. No resources, no continuity, you know, no whatever. But that's a whole giant area of research that could well bear fruit. But secondly, you know, most UFO cases can be identified. We know that. You know, we're talking about the fun ones here, the ones that are interesting, and that's fine. We should focus on that. But there are many, many sightings in those files that are IFOs or could be IFOs if we apply new knowledge today to it. I don't have a specific case, but imagine the following. There's a case in the file where an airline pilot was flying over the central part of the U.S., and they saw these bright, brilliant flashes of something that wasn't lightning because it was higher up in the sky, and it was purple, and it was green, and it wasn't the aurora borealis because it wasn't, you know, lasting for several minutes, and yet it was something weird, and they reported it to the center or to MUFON or someone. In fact, there was something called the Volunteer Flight Officers Network. I'm VFON. I'm blowing the name, but it was run by a couple of guys that basically compiled sightings of odd things in the sky by pilots. And voluntary was in the name, right? You don't go through the airline. You don't go to Blue Book. You go, it was mostly, by the way, meteors and things, but it also included UFOs. Well, some of you may know what I'm referring to by my description of green and purple and red was sprites and blue jets, right? The phenomena that was ignored.
The lightning that goes up instead of down.
Yeah, well, exactly. It was ignored by the atmospheric sciences community because they didn't record it. And they didn't pay attention to sightings by people like pilots and others. And I can't blame them entirely, no. But right. When they finally had enough high-speed cameras around, then they said, oh, look at this. Oh, I guess all those people were correct in what they're reporting. Oh, well. But you know, and it's a very interesting phenomenon, and I'm glad we've quote-unquote discovered it. So those things, I'm sure, if I look long and hard, or Dave did now, we'd find something like that in the files. So, you know, going back to comb through the files with current knowledge is another very worthwhile thing to do.
I agree with Mark wholeheartedly. And Martin, you know, I've talked about the Hobbs, New Mexico case from 64. I did exactly what Mark described. I found that report, found some of the audio recordings, found it to be credible based on, you know, the fact it was documented. He was hospitalized, et cetera, after the encounter. And there was other witnesses. And I hope to lecture on that later this year because a lot of lectures were canceled, unfortunately, due to COVID last year. But to add to what Mark said, especially those like the Hobbs case where it was a young boy in 64, because obviously with the passage of time, we're going to lose some of these witnesses, but especially young witnesses, say from the 60s or even maybe late 50s, you know, to Mark's point, these witnesses might still be alive. And, you know, they're a walking testament to what transpired. And it's especially interesting, as Mark alluded to, we know what they said based on the report in 64. Oh, there we go. Thank you, Martin. We know what they said in 64. Do they still stick to the story? Have they had any ill effects as a result since then in the subsequent years? And in the case of Charles Keith Davis that you showed right there, you know, no ill health effects. You know, he seemed to bounce back and in fact didn't even have any scarring, which is amazing when you look at the documents and the, you know, documented accounts in the newspaper articles from the time.
Yeah, his ears were swelled up so much that they closed.
They looked like ground beef is how they were described.
Yeah, what a case that was. Mm-hmm. Mark, a question for you. When I showed that earlier, I showed that that short film with J. Allen Hynek. He actually showed that film. I can't remember exactly where it was.
There were two films they showed, the Great Falls, Montana film and the Tremont in Utah film.
Yeah, the Utah one, right. Do you have those films? Are those films and still exist?
Those films still exist. I mean, they still exist. Actually, the guy that has the best copy of them, I believe, is Bruce McAfee. Because Bruce, had been the specialist for years in photos and videos in the field. Right. And he's still around, but he's basically retired now. There's dispute and even uncertainty within the UFO community about whether the Tremont in Utah, which was the second one that was on that clip, is really seagulls or not. It's really not certain. I think the first one, though, the Great Falls, Montana film, I believe those are much more likely to be UFOs. The only possible explanation is that there were two fighter jets returning to the nearby Air Force base, and they just doesn't match up with what was the time and you know, the location on the film that was taken right by at the ballpark there, Nick Marianis, the fellow who took the film. So, and even though it's short, it's clear as day that something weird was going through the sky. And also the other thing about that kind of film is that, yeah, I know you can't rely on visual testimony, but this is a guy who saw planes regularly, you know, going to that Air Force base and planes in general. And he took a film of this because he said, well, this essentially, this isn't anything I normally see. I better film this thing. And unlike the French witness, he managed to think about the camera.
Mm. Yeah. When you look at the second film, like you mentioned, it does look like a lot of the films that you see out there that do later get, I don't want to say debunked, but figured out as birds at a high level. It does look a bit like that.
Yeah, and Martin, I do have a vintage copy of the Tremonton film footage that I got when I acquired the Blue Book collection from Rob Mercer in Ohio. That was some of what was found. It doesn't yield any more information. In fact, there's some deterioration of the film. And Rob, to his credit, before he donated that material to the collection here, he digitized all that. So he was able to preserve that version or that copy digitally. But you know, I'm kind of, for those that know me personally, I'm a historian, but I'm also very sentimental when it comes to stuff. And I know we can digitize this, but I like to have the originals that I can get my hands on, or a vintage copy, just to have it. And it's actually here in my Blue Book display case.
I know exactly what you're talking about. This is a question for you, David. Have you come across any cases with triangular UFOs that appeared to have a clear connection to water?
Yeah, actually, I have. I wouldn't say that there's a strong correlation with bodies of water and triangular UFOs, but, you know, just citing one of the more popularized accounts during the Belgian wave, the first night, if you will, that really launched that wave was November 29th, 1989. And near La Galeppe Dam, they had one UFO that was observed by the gendarmes Nico and von Montagy, who observed that. And I've been in touch with Patrick Ferren over in Brussels over the years. And we've talked about that case. And I know they were reinvestigating that about a year or two ago. That was one where there seemed to be focus or attention drawn to that area because there were beams of light. There was a red ball that was descending that looked like, almost as if it was measuring something, was what one of the officers described. And then there's a number of other ones that have been reported. And of course, most recently, which I think we're all waiting with bated breath to see more information on, is this purported naval encounter, Navy fighter that observed one coming out of the ocean. and so and purportedly photographed. So that one will be interesting if that's eventually released and properly vetted and analyzed.
Yeah, if I could just add to what Dave said, is that Carl Feint, who unfortunately passed away a year or two ago, was the leading investigator researcher on cases with UFOs near, in, or under water. Mm-hmm. And has a website, waterufo.net, and a book on it. And if you're really interested in learning about not just triangular UFOs, of course, but right. in general, you know, what UFOs have been associated with water, that is the source to go to.
It's an exhaustive work. Carl did a wonderful job compiling all those historical cases.
Wow. Well, we're going to open up the lines, but I did want to, I did mention in the beginning of the show that we're going to be talking more or less about contemporary cases. David, you just brought up the possible image that may come out someday of the triangle UFO coming out of the water. I don't know, Mark, if you have any more current events you'd like to speak on?
KUFOs, even though, of course, I pay attention to sightings and all the rest, and Dave does too, David, you know, it's neither one of us focuses, you know, that's not our specialist area. Right. And the center, and by the way, what does the center do? If I could just get, you know, 30 seconds in that, because
yeah, sure.
Yeah, I didn't start with that earlier, because what we don't do, and by design, is try to investigate lots of cases. That Dr. Hynek said, let's not do that. Let's let MUFON do that and APRO and so forth. And so we work on specialized research projects in addition to amassing a giant database, of course, of cases we get from various sources. Doing all of that, you know, we do historical research on all types, but we do specialist work like years ago Roswell, or my work with abductees, or it's my monograph on vehicle interference and so forth and so on. On and on. But what we don't do is try to go out and investigate, you know, every possible UFO sighting and gather them. We figure specialization and, you know, let people do what they're good at, like MUFON, and let us do something else. I will say that I've been tempted lately to contact the folks who are investigating Mothman sightings, because you may know that we're getting Mothman sightings allegedly near O'Hare Airport. And I live only 5 miles from the east side of the airport, and I'd love to go out and see a Mothman.
Wow. Kathy keeps asking this question several times. I don't know if either one of you have been in touch with Cheryl Costa regarding her research.
Absolutely. In fact, I just on Facebook, I just sent her a message yesterday or the day before, I believe. Cheryl and I spoke at the MUFON Symposium in Florida about 3 or 4 years ago. And shortly thereafter, I had inquired, because I have her book and I really appreciate her research because, again, it's data driven. I think that's important.
Yeah.
I asked her if she had access to Larry Hatch's UFOU database, which I now have, and which I'm receiving some of Larry's research materials from his family members. She stated no, she didn't have access to it. So I sent her the disks and DOS disks. Unfortunately, it was written in DOS. And so sent her that information to hopefully contribute to her work, additional case information. And the version I had, and Mark and I have talked about this over the years, it's not the latest, but it's, I think it's the second latest version before Larry fell into ill health. It has over 17,000 cases contained in there. So I sent that to Cheryl just to try to help her with her work and give her another data set to work with.
Wow. Interesting. We have a call. We have Rob calling from Pennsylvania. Yeah. Rob, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello. Hey,
you might have to speak up a little bit. How are you?
Oh, good.
That's better.
And thanks to your guests. It's always wonderful to hear the information that they have. I have kind of a general question. I'm sorry, I couldn't think of anything that was specific to the topic about UFO files and stuff. But to your guests, are you aware of any organizations, for example, USGS, United States Geological Survey? If I were graduating from high school, I might call the USGS wanting to work for USGS in the field of geology and ask them, what classes I should take in school, in college, to after graduation, get a job there. Are there any organizations that you know of that a graduate from high school could call and say, I'd like to work for you researching or doing, you know, work with UFOs? I know it sounds a little bit different, but I guess because I can't think of any. Are there any organizations that someone could call and talk to the human resource person there and say, you know, I'd like to go to school to do UFO research and study. What should I, you know, what field should I major in?
Let me answer that, because I've been running the center for so long. But let's start with this. Nobody works in UFOs, you know, basically for a job, except a couple of people at MUFON and all the rest. So everybody's a volunteer. Okay, let's start there. That said, though, absolutely, kids contact us regularly. And what they say is, I want to be a ufologist, essentially, when I grow up and finish school. What should I do? What should I study? And our advice is straightforward. We lots of different types of information, fields of study, you know, whatever will apply to studying UFOs. And I'll list a few, you know, whether it's psychology, physics, chemistry, or whatever. So I say, what you need to do is don't worry about UFOs right now at all. Get a good education. Pick any area you're interested in, because you've got to be interested in what you're studying. Finish that degree, then come back to us and we'll talk. And that is, I believe, the best advice you can give to anybody who is thinking of going to an area like this, because, again, no paid employment, you know, and no good career prospects. I also regularly get contacted, including just 3 weeks ago, by people who are already professionals, very well-established professionals, and will contact us and say, okay, first thing is, you can never tell anybody I'm talking to you, but I'm super interested in UFOs. I don't know how to get involved, but I want to get involved somehow. I want to bring, you know, the skills I currently have to this subject. You know, what can I do? So that's a different thing, but it's related to what Rob, our caller, is asking. And of course we talk about that. And sometimes I can find a way to help them get involved. And, you know, sometimes I can't, you know, so now I will say there's areas where it's hard to figure out whether their education would help directly. Recently we were contacted by a lawyer. And great, smart, you know, like most lawyers and all of that. But fortunately, we don't need legal services right now. So, you know, then you have to guide them into something else. But in any case, that's my usual answer to those kind of questions.
Dave, you have anything to add?
Well, I would just add that, you know, with the exception of what Mark just alluded to, as far as like legal assistance, as far as the sciences go, and Mark can correct me if I'm wrong, I would argue any science or scientific background can come to bear with regard to this subject, because there's such a scope to the variability of cases that we're dealing with. Are you a metallurgist? Yes, obviously that could come in handy if we ever had physical materials that we needed to analyze. Are you an aerospace expert? Great. You can talk to us about, you know, how craft move at high velocities through the upper atmosphere. Are you a meteorologist? Of course, we want to have someone with meteorological background to, you know, be able to help educate people about lenticular clouds and how they're often photographed and mistaken for UFOs. All of the scientific disciplines, I think, can come to bear on this. Even a marine biologist, when we start looking at USOs, you know, unidentified submersible objects,
And engineers, it doesn't have
and
to be
engineers,
right?
So absolutely, physicists. In fact, one of my idols, Dr. James McDonald, atmospheric physicist. Yeah. Obviously, that comes into bear when we're talking about objects being seen in the upper atmosphere.
Yeah, and you know, I think you look at the SCU and a few other things and UFO data, right, Mark? You involved in that,
right?
That are these are science people that are taking this topic seriously and looking deeply into it. And science is a great background. Thank you for that call.
And thank you. Thanks, Mark, David, sure. and Martin. I love the stuff you guys do. Keep it up. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Rob. Take care. Thanks. So the line's open. And again, that number's up on the screen. If you're over at KGRA Radio, that's 855-472-5483. I think it's interesting that, you know, in the last couple of years, it just seems like more and more people are taking this topic seriously. Yeah,
you know, that's a good segue, Martin, if we may, since I guess there's no call right now to say right. A couple of things. And talk a little bit about this supposed report that the government is supposed to produce, right, at the request of Congress. But and I think Dave can elucidate and illuminate us on that. But let me start with just step back. There is no way that anybody in the UFO community would have envisioned where we are now 5 years ago, right? Where we are now with this incredible openness to the subject, this incredible interest in the subject. Yes, of course, most of the mainstream media is still, you know, downplaying things, but not all of them. And as I mentioned, with the lawyer who contacted us, with this professor who contacted us, and I could keep going, the things have just flipped completely in terms of the quality of people interested in the field, in terms of the, you know, the kinds of articles that are being written. You know, more and more serious podcasts, Martin, like yours, which, you know, of course you started before that, but yours is a good example of this and the kind of guests you're getting. This is just completely unanticipated. And of course, you know, I'm still alive to see it happen, so I'm very pleased. However, that doesn't really mean that in terms of the institutions of society, not just the military, but the National Science Foundation, where most of the funding comes for things, and other places or professional societies, that they're necessarily going to be open to this like the rest of us are. Right. And Seth Shostak, which you started the program with, is a great example of that.
Hmm.
So, yeah. But then secondly, you know, because we were talking about this as we started. So, you know, the 6 months from now, roughly, there is supposed to be, we hear, a report produced to respond to Congress's request to tell them, you know, what I said, essentially what the government knows about UAPs, right, as they're called. But maybe. So I don't know, David, do you want to?
Yeah.
We have another caller, but go ahead, Dave.
Absolutely. I just wanted to you know, add to what Mark just said that, you know, I reached out to some people I know within the intelligence community, retired, and, you know, just ran that by them and just said, you know, what do you think of all this about, you know, all this media attention and excitement and people using, you know, the big word disclosure with a capital D? Do you really think that this is going to blow the lid wide open? And they just laughed and basically conveyed that that's under comments at the end of this report. There is absolutely no mandate or rule stating that they have to adhere to it. It's a suggestion. It's a request. It's not an order. It's not a mandate. And so if we're pleasantly surprised in 6 months, that's great. But I am not losing any sleep over the anticipation like a child, you know, the morning before Christmas, getting ready to open my Christmas gifts. I'm not losing any sleep over this one. Yeah. I'm really not expecting it. And if they do provide something substantive to the committee, the odds of us seeing that is slim next to nil. They did request an unclassified report, but that being said, that still does not mean it's going to be within the public domain. And all we have to do is look at the previous cases involving the naval footage. We have the footage, but has anybody seen a detailed analysis or report or an intelligence assessment? We haven't seen anything. So, and I'm not saying that in a disparaging way. You know, these are sensitive matters. It not necessarily related to the UAPs, but how the information's collected, the frequencies of some of the detection systems. There's sensitive national defense aspects to this that simply cannot just be thrown out there.
Right, right. We have Ron calling from Minnesota. Ron, welcome back.
Hey, Martin, how you doing? And great show again tonight. I don't know how you do it every week, but anyway, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you.
The question I have for all three of you is, what do you think of? Is it nuts and bolts, or is it a parallel universe?
Just an opinion.
Okay, yeah.
If it's option A and B, I'll say C, possibly all the above.
Yeah, I'll say that and more. I think Martin, you said something about our future. You know, if I'm not a big believer in the possibility of time travel, but I'm not going to rule it out either. Nuts and bolts, we talk about what it really means is, you know, they're here in our universe, because a parallel universe, if they get here, they might then be quote unquote nuts and bolts, right? They might be physically instantiated here and be around, and you could touch them and everything. But yeah, it's fun to speculate. And we did a lot of that sitting around the center table over the years in the library room. But it's too early, really, to pin this down. I tell you what's really important, though. This question comes up, and what we need is ways to test that kind of a question. So Ron says, is it this or is it that? And I say, great, yeah, it could be either one, could be C, like Dave said, could be whatever. But we're not going to get anywhere unless we say, like scientists do, okay, if it's A, then the following things are probably true, A, B, C, D, and E, okay? And if it's B, these things are true. Oh, but wait a minute, but there's these two here don't overlap with B, you know, so there's this, these two things here, this is the Popperian theory about falsifying scientific theories, or the Popperian approach is Karl Popper, is to say, okay, find a way to differentiate and to test theories. And you don't show theories are true, you disconfirm them, you show they're false. And so the idea is to set up tests for things and be able to do that. Now, we're still in the pre-stage here of a paradigm. You know, if somebody can think of how to do that, you know, all hats off to them. Nobody has thought of a way to do that yet. But that's the ultimate goal of studying UFOs, is to find ways to test hypotheses.
Excellent.
Thank you very much, Martin, and thank you again for the show. And we'll talk to you next time.
All right, Ron. Thank you. Yeah, that makes so much sense. I mean, I wish that could be done, but it is, like you said, it's almost like a process of elimination in a way, is what it sounds like you're talking about.
Yeah, well, let me tell you about, and I bet you very few people are going to know about what, I'll talk about now, but back in the Condit Project days, one of the scientists involved was a psychologist named David Saunders. And Dave, though he was a psychologist, and he did work on some of the witness-related things with the project and investigations, Dave was a stats guy, you know, like I was in my PhD in sociology. And so Dave was interested in studying trends and patterns in the data. And he, in fact, started the UFOCAT database that the center now has. That's a whole other database we haven't even talked about, and we won't have time in this show. So Dave used the initial versions of it to study patterns in the data. And this had happened before with Amy Michelle in France, looking at whether UFOs move in straight lines and so forth. Well, Dave thought he found a couple of very interesting patterns in the data. And one of them is easy to relate to, and that is that UFO waves occur every 61 months. But not only that, they move in longitude around the world. They move 30 degrees in longitude around the world. So every 61 months or so, there's a UFO flap or wave, but it moves not, it doesn't happen here, it happens 30 degrees in longitude over this way. That's hypothesis. Dave had some ideas about why that would be, and yes, he did believe that there, you know, was intelligence, possible aliens involved, but that was a testable hypothesis. And it has been tested and shown to be untrue. Now, that one was limited enough that we don't really know what that means. You know, it by the way, he found it because there was such a pattern in previous data, at least a crude pattern. But the fact that it hasn't carried on since then, well, again, we can all think about, you know, what that means. But there's an example of a limited thing that somebody discovered in the data. And said, and you can see why, you know, unlike other things, it's like, you know, okay, well, I'll look 5 years from now and see if something happens. And, you know, the answer is unfortunately not really. Same thing's true with Jacques Vallée. Jacques and others looked into whether UFOs occurred more often near the time of Mars opposition, when Mars was close to the planet. It would have been easier to travel from Earth to Mars, which is why we, in times when we send our probes, our space vehicles there. That seemed to be holding up for a while in the 50s and early 60s, and then that correlation vanished as well. So those are examples of interesting little patterns and the kind of things that you begin to think about when you say, what can I actually drill down on and begin to test with UFO data?
Someone had a question up there about the Belgian wave, but it looks like it's gone. They must have taken it down. But that's a interesting case in itself. I mean, the whole thing.
Right. What was it, well, a couple of years? If there's no other question, I'll spout on further here about patterns.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I do have another question, but I'll wait.
Oh, yeah. Let's take the question. Sure.
All right. This is John wants to know whether there's any individuals or groups that are monitoring groups in other nations who deal with the UFO community.
I suspect, because if his English isn't good, he's probably saying, are we in communication with, do we work with other groups? I think that's because we're not monitoring them, right? Why would we monitor?
It sounds like he's asking if there's any outside monitoring, for information, government monitoring or something.
Yeah. I mean, not that I'm aware of.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So that's it for the questions. And again, the line's wide open. Anyone can call 855-472-5483. Bill is standing by.
Martin?
So go ahead.
I just wanted to share this just as one example. During the break, I went and pulled this because I just was working on this morning. Someone had asked about triangular UFO reports. This is a very early report right here. And there you can see triangular noted on the face sheet of the report.
Wow. And hold it up. Just one thing, Dave. Show them the source at the top. In other words, which organization or where it came from, right?
Yeah.
What report form it is.
There we go.
1968, Georgia.
I believe this is NICAP.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a NICAP form.
Yep.
NICAP had several types of forms, but that was one of them.
Yep, that's one of the versions. And I just wanted to share this. This was a case from, and I'm not going to go into detail by any means in the interest of time, but this was November 25th, 1968. And I just wanted to share this because unlike, and Mark, I'm sure we'll agree on this point, unlike some witnesses that are terrible artists, I thought this was a very interesting sketch.
Wow.
And
that's,
you can't see
the original sketch right there.
Yeah, and you can't see it up here, but they described it as a triangle with bulging sides, which you see in the middle. Initially, they saw it as a light approaching. When it was directly overhead, you see the middle graphic. And then as it was moving away, I guess you could say they saw the back of the thing and you could see the array of lights. But that was just one I found this morning, actually. So I just wanted to share that just as an example of what we're dealing with.
Oh, great. That's great. You found that, Dave. And you know, that brings up a little bit of another, not a statistical pattern that people have studied, but something we all recognize, which is notice that triangle UFO doesn't look quite like the triangle UFOs that are reported these days, right?
Right.
You know, what's your classic triangle UFO now? First of all, it's not bulgy, right? Rectangular. And so what else, Dave? Dave's the expert. So what else? How would you describe the current typical triangle?
Well, I'd say it's more like this one from September 1960, which I came across. And actually, I wrote about this in my book.
There you go.
Yeah.
Lights on the corners and a light in the middle.
Yep.
So you think that was like a 1968 model?
Well,
the other one. Hey, we have another call if you're ready.
Yeah, no, I just, triangles are not unlike many of the other things. And, Mark, I love his monograph on vehicle interference cases. I absolutely loved when I read that before I think I even knew Mark. And it just goes to show that there do appear to be certain patterns in the data. And it's just, we're not going to find those unless we start parsing the data and really looking at it.
Oh, dear. We only have 5 minutes and we got two callers. So let's go through these quick. We have right now, James from Texas. How are you, James? Quick question.
Hey, good, Martin. How are you guys? Hey,
well, thank you.
Good.
Yeah, I was going to see if J. Allen Hynek, did he ever, was he ever kind of remorseful that he had kind of debunked all that stuff, and especially like the swamp gas thing. You know, what did he say about that? Because a lot of people kind of don't like that guy. Cause that was the most ridiculous thing ever. And I saw the Phoenix Lights, 1997. So I never saw it. Probably a TR-3B or whatever it is, because it was a big black triangle. But did you ever say anything about that?
There was a little garbo. So, Martin, what is our caller asking?
I'm sorry. I could hear him pretty clearly. He was asking if J. Allen Hynek ever had a regret for, you know, being a debunker in the beginning.
Oh, yes, absolutely. He didn't regret way in the beginning, okay, which was the, you know, 48 or so and 49 when he was brought in to give just astronomical explanations of sightings. But he regretted being a skeptic for too long. And he certainly regretted making the swamp gas statement, though there's a whole backstory to that as to why he did it and the pressure he was under. But yeah, the bottom line is that Alan, you know, realized after the fact that, gee, I should have been more even courageous, quite frankly, and, you know, stepped up to the plate earlier. But again, it was not easy to do that when faced with the scientific establishment, you know, arrayed against him.
I bet. We have Drew calling from Toronto. Welcome to the show, Drew. Quick question.
Oh.
You're on, Drew.
Yeah. Oh, hi. Yeah, hi. Sorry. Just let me mute this. Hi. Yes, I wanted to ask I apologize if this has been asked because I missed part of the show. If there's any movement to start a physical archive for UFO material in North America that you're aware of, anybody there, Mark?
That's what Dave does, don't you, Dave? Don't you have?
Well, this is one example, but Mark, there's also a group down in Austin as well that has a pretty good comprehensive paranormal UFO archive as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. The Austin, the Anomaly Archive, mm-hmm. They did a fundraiser recently and all that. And of course, MUFON has pretty good files. I mean, they're, mm-hmm. you know, MUFON's, of course, you know, very viable and, you know, very valuable organization. But beyond that, in the States, you know, there isn't as much. Having three places is good. I mean, there's a few other archives that have material, but, you know, the leading archive in the whole world, though, is AFU in Sweden. By far.
Hands down. Is that where Klaus Vaughn is involved in?
Yes. Yeah, Klaus Vaughn, right.
Yeah, he's great.
And it's not so much case reports. It's case reports, too, but it's every other darn thing you can think of.
Yeah, he says he has everything there. Excellent. Yeah. Well, guys, I can't believe it, but we're at the end. How about that? That went pretty fast, didn't it?
Past 2 hours, yeah. It was fun.
It was fun, and thank you so much. And where can – I am putting in the show notes links with your website, but so people can contact you through those, the links, right?
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And excellent. Thank you so much. I'm kind of closing you in the curtain here. All right. Have a great one, guys. Mark. Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. All right. That's it for the show. And it's possible we may have John Greenwald next week, but some things have kind of turned on upside down on their head for him. So we may not be able to make that happen. So I will have a guest next week. I will tell you that. I just don't know who it is at this point. Thank you so much, everyone, for being here in the show, whether you're listening on YouTube or you're listening podcast. We appreciate it, and we'll see you next week. Stay safe and keep your eyes to sky.